We're here today on the Dean Craft versus Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company case. May I have the entry appearances, please, first for the plaintiff.
Scott Larson, also on behalf of Mr. Craft.
All right, Ms. Hammond, will you begin with the arguments? Thank you. And for the defendant?
Beth Culp, Philadelphia Insurance Company.
John Dolan, and Paul Adams.
Thank you. And who will be doing the arguments?
I will, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Counsel, this case is set for 1 hour. That means, of course, that each side has a half an hour. Ms. Hammond, you'll have to keep track of your own time if you wish to have any kind of a rebuttal argument. So you may go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to start today by saying that I've never in my career faced a string citation of 2.5 pages long in my opponent's brief. But I want to say that nonetheless, and despite that string citation, I want to talk to you about the reasons that weren't discussed or weren't analyzed by the courts in that string citation as to why this court should determine that the notice prejudice rule applies to claims-made policies, and at a minimum, to claims-made policies that are successively renewed with prior acts provisions in them. So let me start with the Friedland case. In that case, this court held, articulated a rule of law with respect to liability policies. It said that the notice prejudice rule applies to liability policies. And Justice Corliss, in her dissent, said, this court extends the notice prejudice rule to general liability insurance cases. There was no discussion in the context of the holding of the court that holding was limited to occurrence policies. So for 10 years now, courts, lawyers, parties have relied on that holding in this state with respect to claims-made policies and occurrence policies alike. And Justice Coates, in your dissent in the Friedland case, you talked about the continued confidence in the legitimacy of court-made law. And in your dissent, you said, if the highest court of a jurisdiction no longer accepts, even in principle, that its current disposition is constrained by or its prior pronouncements, its judgment becomes as ephemeral as the makeup of the court at any given moment in history. And so the party's reliance, the court's reliance, attorney's reliance on the court's holding in Friedland is something that I think the court needs to take into account in its ruling on this case.
Well, I'm sure you may address this later on, but I'm very curious, after reading all the briefs, whether, if that is settled law, then whether or not the insurance policy premium has been adjusted to take that into account. You know, part of the argument is that claims made are much cheaper, and so, you know, there ought to be a known deadline. You've got to meet it, make the claim. Has the industry then adjusted its premiums to take into account that additional risk?
There's nothing in the record on that, Your Honor. And, you know, I don't know the internal workings of the insurance industry, but presumably, given that general proclamation of law in the case, they should take that into account. They know the law as well as we do when the Supreme Court issues its decision. Now, one of the questions that the court may have was, okay, maybe this case probably involved an occurrence policy, the Friedland case. I think it appears that that's true. But the important thing is the court never mentioned in its opinion this applies only to occurrence policies. It never even pointed out the fact this is an occurrence liability policy. And that's in stark contrast to the Clemente case, where the court specifically said, our holding only applies to UIM policies here. So the fact that the court didn't so limit its decision in Friedland here is significant. I think Philadelphia has argued, well, this case involved an occurrence policy, and so that Friedland should be limited to occurrence policies. One can always try to distinguish a case based on its particular facts. But that fact has to mean something. And when a court articulates a general rule of law, the lower courts and the parties and the attorneys should be able to rely on that. And I am an example of that. Not long ago, this court abolished the sudden emergency doctrine in the, I think it's the Better case or the Vitor versus Johnson case. As an attorney practicing in the courts below, when the court makes a general pronouncement of law in that fashion, we abolish the sudden emergency rule. We're entitled to rely on that and say, okay, that case may not just apply to the situation where there was an icy road, as it was in that case. It would also apply to a situation where a person suddenly darts out into traffic. So I think the fact that the court stated that the notice of prejudice rule applied to general liability policies and the stare decisis doctrine should be considered here in the court's ruling on this case.
Let me ask you, although just to clarify the facts there, this policy may have been purchased after your client left. Did I miss something there?
It did after he was an employee, but the language of the policy encompasses prior officers and directors and employees. So,
and there's no contest on that, or not?
There's no issue, at least at this point. The only disputed issue below was with respect to adequate notice. So I want to go on and talk a little bit about the public policy considerations in the Freeland case. And I'm not going to dwell too much on what we said in our opening brief, but I do want to talk about Philadelphia's arguments with respect to those public policy considerations. First, they say, our policies aren't adhesive in nature. Look, they were approved by the Division of Insurance here. But they do admit in their brief that their policies are just forms. And they admit that D&O liability policies are written generally on a claims-made basis. Indeed, the amici who filed briefs in support of their position said that those policies are almost exclusively written on a claims-made basis. So it is not like the insurers for professional liability policies or D&O policies like this have a lot of bargaining power. The Tenth Circuit said that, well, these policies are less adhesive in nature than occurrence-based policies because insureds can go out and buy a tail for a claims-made policy. Well, that really isn't more bargaining power. What it is the opportunity to spend a whole bunch more money to make your claims policy what it is, in essence, an occurrence-based policy.
Well, let me get this straight, though. You're saying the expectation of businesses who buy these policies is that the Freeland case it basically applies. It's going to be a notice prejudice rule.
I believe so. I think the parties are entitled to rely on that.
So unless something is done by the industry to counter that or make a specific change to the policy that puts people on aware of that, they're entitled to rely on what Justice Carlos was pointing out, is that the court made the rule more generally applicable.
Absolutely.
And she disagreed with that result.
Absolutely. That is what we were saying, that insureds are entitled to rely on the current state of the law.
Ms. Hanneman, good morning. What do we do then with the language of this particular policy, which says during the policy period? I mean, it talks about claims made against individuals during the policy period. If they wanted, they could negotiate a claims made policy or an occurrence-based policy, but in this case, the contract itself says during the policy period, correct?
Well, I think that the same argument could be made in Freeland. I mean, in Freeland, even though the claim doesn't have to be made during the policy period, the point is that there are factors that trigger insurance. And in an occurrence-based situation, they could just as easily say, well, the policy said you have to give us notice as soon as practicable, and you didn't meet that term. You breached that term of the policy, and therefore, you don't get the notice prejudice rule. So I think that argument could have been made just as well in Freeland.
But it wasn't. I mean, because it wasn't that type of a contract. I mean, sometimes opinions don't address things that aren't raised.
Well, I think that what we're doing is we're getting into the more sort of philosophical question about whether courts should be regulating insurance contracts. And it's well settled that the courts have been regulating these insurance contracts because they're not ordinary bilateral contracts. So if you're saying, yes, this is what the exact language of the policy provides, the courts have to go one step further and take a look whether the reasonable expectations of the insureds have been met, whether the contract comports with public policy, and fairness. And so the courts here have never hesitated to look beyond that language in a contract to protect insurers if it's based on a public policy interest or fairness. The other factor is, and I'll get into this a little more later, is that when you have a successively renewed policy that has a prior facts provision in it, the argument in Philadelphia doesn't work. What they're saying is we can close the books on our claims-made policies, and that's why they're more beneficial for insurers, and that's why they're less expensive, and that's going to support the public interest in compensating tort victims. But the fact of the matter is that when there's a successively renewed policy with the prior acts provision, that reasoning doesn't apply because the risk is extended out to another policy period. The risk is always there that there could be a wrongful act that was committed during the prior policy, that, and there is a claim for that in the second or third policy period. And so this idea that they can close the books on a policy and, you know, transfer their reserves to profits when there are successively renewed policies doesn't hold water.
Counsel, if I could perhaps get you to focus on the distinction between the two different types of notice provisions at issue in this particular policy, because the notice provision at issue in Friedland was a soon as practical, a prompt notice type of provision. And that aspect is not what's at stake here. What we have here is a date certain notice provision. And so to me, that strikes me as qualitatively different type of notice that serves a different purpose. So could you respond to that and why then the public policy rationale that applies to a prompt notice provision transfers over to a date certain type of notice provision?
I understand what you're saying. I think that there may be some difference in terms of what the insurers are doing in terms of those different notice provisions. Certainly, even in a claims-made policy, that date certain provision is there's a requirement for that so that the insurance company knows about the claim, has an opportunity to investigate the claim, has an opportunity to participate in settlement, just like an occurrence-based policy. But I agree, there is a difference. And here, there was also a soon-as-practicable provision. But what we're saying is that given the policy interests in Freedom, that those policy interests are implicated just as well by this date certain deadline. And let me give you an example. I mean, if you have an insured that gives notice after the date certain, 1 day late, 2 days late, 2 weeks late, is it really true that the insurance company is going to be prejudiced by it? Don't we want to have flexibility in our law so that we can address those types of situations where the insurer really isn't going to be prejudiced and there is going to be a catastrophic loss for the insurer, a very significant forfeiture, even if they paid all of the premiums?
And I guess where I'm going with it is to describe the prompt notice provision as sort of a technicality, in other words, something that allows the insurer to provide a defense and so forth, strikes me as something different than the state certain provision, which at least it's been argued is a material term of a claims made policy. It's sort of part and parcel of that insurance product.
I think it depends upon the facts of the situation if that date certain is a technicality, like if we're talking about 1 week or 2 weeks. And what I'm saying is that this court should provide lower courts with at least the flexibility if we have some kind of delay of a short period of time And so that the policy interests of Friedland can be met. It is more of a technicality when it's just 1 or 2 weeks late. Now, you may ask, well, your client wasn't just 1 or 2 weeks late. But that's why I think that it's important to consider our argument regarding successively renewed policies.
Would it be unfair to say then that you understand Friedland to have, in the insurance agreement context, to simply say this is not a matter as to which bargaining between the parties is possible? It simply violates public policy to set a date after which the claim cannot be made?
I don't think it necessarily violates public policy. I think that there was a case where a party has already argued that the very nature of these policies violate public policy.
Does that mean then that the parties could, and how expressly would they have to do it then to negotiate this kind of a condition?
Well, my understanding is that for the most part, and I think this court has recognized it, that these types of policies are offered on a take it or leave it basis. So I don't see negotiation occurring in these types of policies, but you know, I suppose you can always ask, but as Philadelphia submitted in its own briefing, it's a form policy. It's a form policy that they've submitted to the Division of Insurance for certification.
So no matter how express the condition were made, if the insurance company could sit down and say, we're not going to give you an insurance policy unless you agree to this, because we don't, you know, that affects our actuarial considerations or whatever. And both parties knew it, and the insured decided to go ahead and insure on that kind of a basis. Nevertheless, that would not be enforceable. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what we're saying is that the court needs this doctrine in terms of flexibility to avoid a forfeiture based on a technicality in the context of a claims-made policy, that there can be a forfeiture that constitutes a technicality if it's a short period of time, and that doesn't prejudice the insurer. And what we're saying is, just like in Friedland, the court shouldn't enforce that policy so strictly that it results in that forfeiture. And you talked a little bit about the reasonable expectations of the insureds.
No, go ahead. Yeah, deep inhale, I apologize.
You talked a little bit about the reasonable expectations of the insureds. And I want to talk about that with respect to the successively renewed policies with prior acts coverage. As I said before, their rationale for why this rule shouldn't apply to claims-made policies doesn't work when it comes to successively renewed policies. None of the cases cited by Philadelphia consider the fact that this closing the books rationale advanced by insurance companies doesn't apply when there are successively renewed policies. And when you look at the reasonable expectations of the insurers when there are renewals, you need to consider the fact that they're paying continuing premiums for what they understand to be continuing coverage. And that's reinforced by the language of these types of policies with respect to the extended reporting provisions. Because the extended reporting provisions are only available when the policy isn't renewed or canceled. So one that would leave an insured to believe that they don't need an extended reporting provision if they renew that policy. And that's discussed in the Tussey and Helbert cases that we have in our briefs. The other language in the policy is that that leads one to believe that they have continuous coverage and they don't need to get an extended reporting provision is the mere language of a renewal. A renewal is an act of extending the policy, the period of time when something is effective or valid under the policy. So I think it's very reasonable to assume that insureds, when they get successively renewed policies, that they do not think that they need to purchase some kind of extended reporting, that they can report a claim even if it spans the two policies. and we've talked about that a little bit with respect to the gap problem with claims made policies in our briefs. And the Castile case talks about that gap problem. And also the briefs of the amici in support of Mr. Kraft's position talk about that gap problem. And the notice prejudice rule can help mitigate that gap problem. I want to talk a little bit about the argument in Philadelphia's brief regarding the regulation by the Division of Insurance. They suggest that because the Colorado disclosure form for claims made policies was attached to its own policy, this somehow prevents the court from reviewing claims made policies for fairness, compliance with public policy, and the reasonable expectations of insurers. And that's just not the case. First, the form doesn't say that the notice prejudice rule doesn't apply. And if the court is to find that the notice prejudice rule applies here, the court would not be ruling contrary to any kind of stated public policy in a statute or regulation. Presumably, the legislature knows what Freeland says, and so they haven't legislated any requirement here for the notice prejudice rule to apply to claims made policies. But the legislature did authorize regulation for these types of policies, and that in and of itself supports this court's scrutiny of claims made policies.
Ms. Hammond, I guess I'm not quite following your argument, only because I'm looking at the disclosure form claims made policy, and it seems to suggest right in the language of that policy that this applies only to if the incident is reported to your insurer prior to the end of the policy period. And then it says upon termination, you can buy an extended reporting period option. That seems pretty clear to me. So the very next paragraph says there's a difference in the kind of injury or damage covered by occurrence or claims made policies, and it goes on and tells you what the differences are and what you have to do in order to fill out this form correctly, more or less. Obviously, very much overstated. So why, I think picking up on what Justice Boatwright said, why isn't this just extremely clear from the policy itself that you can buy this, and if you have problems, you can buy an extension? And that's the way the policy works. The language seems so clear.
Well, what I'm saying with respect to the successively renewed policies is this extended reporting provision that you can exercise. You can only get that if the policy is not renewed or terminated. So then if you renew your policy, the very same policy with the very same company, you can't get that extended reporting. But
you wouldn't need it, though, would you?
Well, yeah.
You might need it if the claim and the report span the two policy periods, and
it would happen. Well, let me help me with this. It would happen one or the other. It happens at a point in time. And so you were talking about a gap. When would the gap even occur?
The gap would occur because there are these two triggering mechanisms for coverage. One is the claims made being the first policy period. The other is notice before the end of the policy period or before the end of that grace period.
Right.
In some situations, the claim could be made during the one policy period and the notice can be given. The person doesn't know about the claim and notice is given during the second policy provision. That's during the second policy renewal. That's the gap problem. And it exists. I mean, in the CTLA brief that was submitted in support of Mr. Kraft's position, it described that problem. It exists with claims-made policies. But the point about the extended reporting provision is that the policies suggest that that is only needed if your policy isn't renewed. In other words, it suggests that you can report in the time period of the second policy or the renewed policy, even though the claim occurred during or was made during the first policy. And the other thing that is, I think, somewhat misleading about these types of policies is, and particularly in this case, there were successive renewals of this policy. They were the exact identical policy that was renewed. So when we're talking about giving notice during the term of this policy, it's not unreasonable for an insurer to think, this is the same policy. I can give notice later in time during the second policy period.
I can tell you're going to move on, so I just want to get my question in here. You started out by saying there was a very long string cite, and you also, I think, tried to distinguish some of those cases. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can help me. Can you point to a case where this notice prejudice rule was applied to a claims-based policy?
Well, yes, and let me talk a little bit about that. In Wisconsin, there is a statute that says that a notice prejudice rule applies to liability policies. There are cases, there's a case from the Seventh Circuit and a case from Wisconsin that find that language in the statute means that it applies to both claims made and occurrence-based policies. Okay. There are other cases that we've cited in our briefs, the Helper case, the Tussie case, and the Castile case, that talk about this gap problem, that talk about the reasonable expectations of insureds when there's a successive renewal. And those cases go as far as to say, well, at least the Castile case did, well, the reasonable expectation of the insured was that there you can give notice until the end of the renewal policies. And so you can do that. We're not even asking that much here. We're just asking the court to consider applying the notice prejudice rule for the reasons discussed in those cases.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Hanneman, before you run out of time, I just wanted to ask you to address, and maybe you're planning to go there, the impracticability and equitable excuse facets of your brief. In the answer brief, Philadelphia says that should apply when we have a presumably sophisticated business person, et cetera. Could you address that for us, that argument about how your client presumably should have been able to acquire knowledge of the existence of this claims-based policy sooner, and why didn't that happen here?
Well, the record is not entirely clear. It was basically all the parties have gone into this dispute understanding that the facts as alleged in the complaint was that our client did not know about the existence of this policy. He was essentially, he was an officer and director, there was stock purchase agreements, then he became an employee, then he left. And so right after that second stock purchase agreement in which he sold all of his stock back to the company, the other company that came in and took control of Campbell Cement purchased the policy. So our client didn't know about it. And so he's not in the situation of being a sophisticated, you know, businessman who knew what he was getting into in the policy. He didn't even know about the policy or the terms of the policy.
So the record really doesn't allow for any inferences regarding why counsel didn't discover it sooner through discovery?
The record is not entirely clear on that front. There's an affidavit from counsel that said he asked for it, and he did receive it, and they gave notice one day after receiving a copy of the policy. But other than that, the record is unclear. I know there have been some allegations or a suggestion in the response brief that there was some kind of wrongdoing on the part of counsel, but I really do think that that's a red herring. It's unfortunate. I really don't think that at this point it's relevant to the issue presented to this court. If I may, I'd like to preserve my last minute and 45 seconds for rebuttal.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Culp.
May it please the court, my name is Beth Culp, and I'm representing the Philadelphia Insurance Company here today. When I was preparing for this argument, I went to this court's website to get familiar with your faces and read your bios, and I was very intrigued to find that there is a discussion on your website about claims made insurance coverage, a link to it, as part of this court's obligation to ensure that lawyers do their, you know, have professional liability coverage, or at least disclose them when they don't. This court has a discussion, a brief word about professional liability malpractice insurance, which I think this court is aware of, is also written on a claims made basis. And on the website, this court's website, it says, most legal malpractice policies are written on a claims made basis. This is different from the usual homeowners or automobile policy. This type of policy means that the insurance company providing the policy has only agreed to cover valid claims that are made against the lawyer during the term of the policy and reported to the insurance company during the term of the policy or within a specified notice period. In other words, the policy that applies to a particular claim is the policy that is in effect at the time the claim is both made against the insurer and presented to the insurance company, not the policy in effect when the lawyer's alleged negligence or mistake took place. And what is really missing in the analysis that's provided by the appellant here is this very critical distinction that you recognize in your web page between an occurrence-based liability policy and a claims-made liability policy.
Let me just be sure I know what that is. That's attorney regulation counsel.
It's a link, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's a link that's right on the webpage about professional liability policy.
Right,
if you touch that link, this is where you go.
Okay.
So it's on this court's website. So the point is that we're dealing with a different trigger mechanism. And if you read the Friedland decision, it's very, very clear that the trigger of coverage in that case is the occurrence of bodily injury, property damage during the policy period. And yes, there is a reference to general liability policies, but when you're a coverage person like I am, and someone uses the phrase general liability policies, it means a policy that is written to provide for general liability exposures, bodily injury, property damage, personal injury, advertising injury. And we know that from Friedland because if you look at the decision, there is reference to the policies being labeled commercial general liability policies. That's a term of art, CGL. It is an occurrence-based form. It provides coverage for bodily injury and property damage caused by an occurrence. And the concern that was addressed by this court in Friedland was that an otherwise covered claim, an otherwise covered event, coverage could be lost for that through the technicality of failing to report as soon as practicable. That's not the situation here. What appellants are asking you to do to this directors and officers liability policy, where coverage is triggered by the claim being made and reported, those are the triggers. It's important to note about this policy that it has unlimited prior acts coverage. There is no retroactive date. So without regard to when the wrongful act happened, there will be coverage so long as the claim is first made and reported during the policy period. And these arguments that are being made about a gap in coverage have nothing to do with this policy. There could be no gap in coverage in this policy unless the insured was absolutely, totally negligent in failing to report. And the reason for that is that the term claim is defined in this policy. And it says, in the definition of claim in the policy, that the claim shall be deemed to have been first made when an insured knows about it. You can't have the situation that has been posed by appellants and their amici. You can't have that situation in this policy because if you don't know about it, it hasn't been made. So you can't have the policy where the suit was filed but it wasn't served. The claim is first made at the time that someone knows about it. The other reason why you can't have a gap in coverage in this policy is that there is an automatic extended reporting period.
You have, after every policy expiration date, the policyholder has an additional 60 days to report the claim to the insurance company. And when that claim is reported, it will be treated as if it were covered under the policy that was in effect at the time the claim was made when the insurer found out about it. So you've got 60 days. So if there's a gap in coverage, I suggest that the insured has only themselves to blame for that. There can be no gap in coverage in this policy. And the cases that are cited, the Helberg case and the unpublished Kentucky decision, Tussie, I think it is, in those cases where they talk about continuous coverage, those were situations where there was not an automatic 60-day or 20-day or 30-day or whatever extended reporting period. So we actually could have a situation where, you know, the insured got notice of it at midnight and the time of expiration, but couldn't get it reported. That can't happen here because notice happens when you know about it and you got an additional 60 days to report. So that's a red herring, and it shouldn't influence this court's decision.
Counsel, can I direct you back? Excuse me. I think you were distinguishing our Friedland case on the basis that it had to be an occurrence policy that was involved there. And I'm wondering if you can address your opposing counsel's argument that Justice Corliss points out, while this is a pretty broad rule, the majority is adopting.
Well,
what do you do with that?
I go back to what Justice Buckwright said. He said, if the issue's not before the court, does the court need to address it? And again, I think there's two ways that you have to read what Justice Corliss said in context of the larger situation. Number one, Clementi was a first-party policy. It wasn't a lot. It was uninsured motorist coverage, which, again, for coverage lawyers, that means it's a first-party insurance coverage, as opposed to a liability, a third-party coverage. So I think that when you talk about, there's two reasonable ways to interpret what you say when you say general liability policies. You can look at it as any liability policy ever written without regard to what provisions the insurance company put in it. You could do that. But if that is what happened here, then I suggest one thing I would challenge opposing counsel to address is, she indicated, I thought that I heard her say that lawyers in Colorado and judges in Colorado since Friedland have relied on the notice prejudice rule as applying to claims made policies, not to my knowledge. And I litigated one of those cases. The Marlowe case cited in our paper was a case that was decided in the federal district court after Friedland. Other side never even raised the idea that notice prejudice would apply or that Friedland would apply. So to my knowledge, no one has ever, until this case, no one had ever taken the position that Friedland altered the trigger in a claims made policy, which is what they're taking the position. So I say Friedland, if you read Friedland from the fact that it refers to commercial general liability policies and defined occurrence is a defined term in the decision. You can see it's defined because it's in boldface type. It only talks about bodily injury, property damage. It clearly doesn't involve, and they now concede, although they didn't originally, an occurrence-based policy. So taking a principle that is would have the effect here of rewriting insurance policies, that are subject to regulation by the Department of Insurance and Division of Insurance.
In light of that, why do you think the Tenth Circuit is taking the position that the law is unclear here?
I think that they were reluctant because of some of the general statements, sort of the global overarching statements in Friedland, to make that call. And they wanted this court to weigh in on it before they did that. And I think it was very deferential for them to do that. I don't think it was necessary, because I think that you, if you read the Friedland decision carefully and you think about all the other overarching public policy concerns that have guided this court's decisions throughout the decades, including freedom of contract, including we will not rewrite an insurance policy, that you would have to look at that and say, you know, that I think the Tenth Circuit could have very easily looked at that and said,
this doesn't apply, the notice of prejudice rule doesn't apply, as other circuit courts have done. No, the notice of prejudice rule, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, finish.
No, the notice of prejudice rule is nothing new. You know, vast majority of state Supreme Courts have applied a notice of prejudice rule to avoid a forfeiture of coverage, of an otherwise coverage claim. But what they want this court to do now is to apply the notice of prejudice rule to create coverage, to rewrite the insurance contract. Surely that is not what Friedman stands for. We're not talking about mere technicality here. We're talking about the event that creates the coverage. We are talking about the fundamental bargain that was struck. And that is, you committed a wrongful act, you have coverage for that wrongful act, if the claim is first made against you during the policy period and reported within 60 days. That's the trigger of coverage. We're not dealing with a forfeiture here based on a mere technicality. There's nothing else that you can pin the trigger to here. Not like in a general liability policy where the trigger is the bodily injury happened during the policy period. We can prove it happened during the policy period. We didn't provide notice for 2 years. If you make that person give up that coverage for the bodily injury based on that, that's a forfeiture. Law abhors the forfeiture. But the law equally abhors rewriting the contracts that people do. And I want to also, if I may, address another argument sort of that the continuous...
Before you go there, may I just jump in? You talk about well-established principles, and obviously one of the well-established principles that appellant emphasizes is the public policy interest in... I'm sorry, I lost my thought. Go ahead, I'll come back to it.
Reasonable expectations?
Well, no, I had another one. You go ahead, I'll come back to it.
All right, well, I would be happy to. I do want to just address the argument that the rationale of closing the books doesn't apply to this case. You know, that whole premise of a claims-made policy and the reason why they can be issued for a lower premium, and again, here it was a $3,000 premium for a $1 million policy, is that the underwriters can make adjustments every year. So if you do have a claim that's made in year one, year two, you're going to get a higher premium. So that close the books, you know, argument does apply when there's continuous coverage because the risk is for a 12-month period, the policy period. And in terms of the reasonable expectations, first of all, based on this court's precedent about needing to have extrinsic evidence of what, in fact, is a reasonable expectation. I don't know how Mr. Kraft could have had any reasonable expectations about what coverage this policy provided because, according to him, he didn't even know about it. So I think that's one issue. The other thing I would point out is that the company that actually purchased the coverage obviously did understand how it applied because when the coverage was not renewed, they purchased an extended reporting period endorsement for $17,000. So they knew, they reasonably understood and had reasonable expectations, and they paid for it. So that's one thing I just wanted to talk about, address, is that whole reasonable expectations.
Well, let me, I actually have my thought.
Okay.
So the reasonable expectation in part would be informed by the notion that there's heightened scrutiny of insurance contracts. So we have this tension here, this fundamental tension between, on the one hand, heightened scrutiny of insurance contracts, not the ordinary bilateral contract, and freedom to contract. So help me to evaluate how much it should matter that we apply heightened scrutiny to insurance contracts, because that seems to be where they ultimately hang their hat.
Well, they do hang their hat on that, and I would suggest this, that you know, unfortunately, we don't have a very extensive record. We really don't have any record of the availability of directors and officers' liability insurance or professional liability, lawyers' malpractice insurance. But they are written on a variety of forms. And all policies are written on form, so I don't know why that's a bad thing. Do you want handwritten insurance policies? I don't think so. This policy had 8 endorsements to it. And if you look at the endorsements to the policy, you'll see like most of them provided expanded coverage. We have no reason to believe in this. They had a broker. Typically brokers have the ability to go out and solicit multiple bids, look at multiple forms. There's no evidence that this policy here was a contract of adhesion, as that, like a homeowner's policy or some of, you know, other kind of form. Of course it is written on forms, but if you compare one director's and officer's liability policy to another one, you'll see they vary extensively. They're not all the same, just as your lawyer's malpractice policy is not always the same. And they are subject to negotiation, particularly when you have a broker involved, and there was a broker involved here. So even if this were a contract of adhesion, and I don't believe there's evidence to that effect, you have to weigh the balance of finding that the notice prejudice rule applies to change to trigger coverage and what that will do to the availability and affordability of insurance coverage issued to directors and officers, to lawyers, to doctors in the state of Colorado. Because it will have an effect. If you change the trigger of coverage that applies to claims made policies, either some carriers will decide not to write here, but more likely than not, what they'll do is they'll increase the premium. And it's already a struggle, as you are well aware, to ensure that doctors are properly insured, that lawyers are properly insured. So I think that is a huge and compelling public policy reason to look very skeptically at the expansion of Freeland to claims-made policies.
Ms. Culp, can I follow up with that?
Of course, Justice.
You're making kind of assertions about that these policies are cheaper because they're finite and that there's going to be an increase. What do we do with the fact that there's no development of any record in this with regard to that? I mean, I feel like sometimes you pluck that out of thin air and there's no basis for it.
Well, also plucking out of thin air on the other side, as you know, in terms of the application of the reasonable expectations, there's nothing in the record about that either. This is sort of what you're having to deal with here. When you win on a motion to dismiss, it's a double-edged sword because you don't have a record. I urge you that to Justice Boatwright, that you know we have in our papers, we have cited to commentators, we've cited to very long and extensive decisions by other courts, Supreme Courts and Federal Courts of Appeal, where they have considered that issue on a full record. I think you can look at the fact that you've got a very regulated situation here with the Division of Insurance being charged with oversight of claims-made liability policies, and they have not elected to put a provision in those policies that provide that to deny coverage based on the failure to report, you must establish that the insurance company has been prejudiced. So, you know, we don't have a very full record. We've done the best we can to present those arguments, but I think that it goes without saying that we all know that certain exposures today are written on a claims-made basis. And we also know that the trigger coverage in those policies is based on those things. And so that in and of itself to me is sufficient to say, how can you justify rewriting the insurance contract and to create coverage where there wasn't? Because that's what the other side is asking you to do. And I think, you know, respectfully, that that's what the Tenth Circuit asked you to look at, was whether or not Freeland requires you to do that. And my answer is no, I don't think it does.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could respond to your opposing counsel's arguments about establishing prejudice. If we were to expand it into this realm, that it would not necessarily be that difficult to establish prejudice if you could simply show the funds held in reserve were reallocated after the books were closed. I wonder what response you had to that.
Well, I would say that it's inappropriate to apply the notice prejudice rule anyway, because prejudice is automatic if you change the trigger of coverage in the liability policy. It's just, let's just take an example. Let's say that you go out and you buy an auto insurance policy and you get replacement coverage for your auto, and you have a Subaru at the time you buy the coverage, but then you get a Mercedes-Benz or a Porsche and you total the car. You know, the prejudice is there because the insurance company never agreed to insure the Porsche. The object of the insurance, the risk insured in a claims-made policy, is the occurrence of the claim being made and reported during the policy period. That's it. If you change that, you prejudice the insurance company. So, you know, I don't understand this argument that, you know, there wouldn't be any prejudice. It's automatic. It would be, because you're changing the deal that was made upon which the premium was written. Just like the Subaru versus the Porsche. If they know they were going to underwrite the Porsche, they want to charge the higher premium. If an insurance company knows that it's going to be underwriting an occurrence-based policy, because that's what it does, if you change the trigger, you change a claims-made policy into an occurrence policy, they want to charge a higher premium. That goes without saying. You can't change the risk that's insured. We're not dealing with a mere technicality.
Well, I take it your example, though, it would be the same if you insured the Mercedes-Benz and then later the insured got a Subaru. You're saying it doesn't make any difference whether the insurance company would be losing money or would have refused to insure the higher value. You're just saying that's not the deal they agreed to.
That's not the deal. That's correct.
So
it's not the deal. The premium was based on the deal that was made. The deal was made at the time the premium was paid. And you can't change the deal.
Wouldn't that be the same argument that you would make, though, for whether or not notice prejudice rules should apply to claims made policies? I mean, the deal's a deal.
The deal's a deal.
Okay, and yet we didn't accept that a deal's a deal with respect to claims made policies.
You mean with respect to occurrence policies?
I mean occurrence policies, yeah.
Right, yes. Well, I think that the difference is that the deal that was made in Friedland didn't have to do with the trigger, Your Honor. We're not talking about the very essence of the coverage, the object of the coverage. We're talking about coverage invested in Friedland. You know, there was property damage that happened, you know, during a 10-year period, as I recall the case, and found that coverage was triggered under multiple policies. So that was triggered, and so what the court said was, we're, like the majority of courts nationally, have said that we're not going to allow a forfeiture in coverage where of an already covered claim. That's different than the situation we have here where they're trying to apply the notice prejudice rule to create coverage that doesn't exist. It's not a mere technicality. It's not a forfeiture. It's the creation of coverage. And that's why it's fundamentally wrong to apply notice prejudice here, and why the vast, vast majority of courts that have considered the issue, and there's a lot of them, and I'm not going to apologize for that string side. There's a lot of them. And they have found that it is wrong-headed and unfair to apply the notice prejudice rule to a claims-made policy. And the only exception, and I want to just briefly address Wisconsin, because that is a case that's in flux. In Wisconsin, there is, in fact, a statute that I am very familiar with. I've dealt with it on a number of occasions. And that statute says that it gives a policyholder basically an additional year to report a claim. And unless the insurance company can show that it's been prejudiced by giving that additional year. So it doesn't provide a forever, you know, it's an additional year. So even under the Wisconsin statute, Mr. Kraft would have been too late. But interestingly enough, so the Seventh Circuit in its ultimate wisdom looked at that statute and they said, we think it applies to claims-made policies. About 10 years later, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals said the same thing. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has accepted review of that Court of Appeals decision. So we don't know
what the Wisconsin Supreme Court will do with that decision. But apart from the situation, and there's a Maryland statute that basically does the same thing, and the industry and the courts have presumed that applies, and the prejudice rule applies to the Huntington policies. But other than legislatures determining what the public policy should be in their state and enacting a statute, there isn't any court anywhere. You know, when the 10th Circuit said Colorado would be an outlier, it would. It would clearly be an outlier. And in a state like this, where you have so many lawyers and so many doctors, not to mention directors and officers, it seems to me that that's kind of a scary proposition to extend the notice prejudice rule to be an outlier. And certainly the insurance industry would counsel against it. And one thing I also want to address too is the paradigm that has been set up here, not only by counsel for Mr. Kraft, but also by the amici that have weighed in on this issue, and that there's this assumption that what is bad for the insurance industry is automatically good for policyholders or tort victims. That's not the case. The interests of tort victims will be served by ensuring the ongoing availability of affordable insurance coverage for corporations, lawyers, doctors, all kinds of professionals, where occurrence coverage just isn't issued anymore. So,
well, you practice this a long time. Explain to me why it's no real practical problem that you'll know within the period you have to make the claim and any extension that you've got to make it. I mean, maybe it's self.
Well, so the policy, Justice Hobbs, defines the term claim to mean a demand for damages, money or services, a civil suit or civil action, right? And the claim is considered made when the insured knows about it.
Right.
And then if you go into the provisions in the policy, the notice provisions in the policy, they elaborate even more, and they say that you have to have, the knowledge has to be by an officer or a director. You know, there's a laundry list of higher ranking folks within the organization that know about it, okay? So if you know about it, and you've got 60 days after the end of the policy period, then this idea that you know there's this big risk of a gap in coverage just isn't. It's not a realistic concern. And here I do want to just address the situation here specifically with Mr. Kraft, because you know when you go to applying public policy, one of the messages that comes through loud and clear from this court is that if we're going to do something on public policy grounds, we want to look at the particular facts of the situation, okay? If we're going to be concerned about public policy, what happened in this case that would warrant imposing public policy? Here, there is no tort victim that wasn't compensated. I mean, ironically, the tort victim was the named insured under the policy. Ironically, if Philadelphia were required to reimburse Mr. Kraft for the amount he paid to settle the fraud claim that was brought against him, that would count against the named insurer because their experience would show that they had a $400,000 or $500,000 loss under that directors and officers liability policy. So the particular facts here, there's no uncompensated tort victim. Mr. Kraft had no reasonable expectations of insurance coverage because he didn't even know about it. He wasn't involved in the negotiations for the coverage. He doesn't know what was discussed. There's a lot of self-serving criticism of Philadelphia and the way it handled and responded to Mr. Kraft's claim when it was finally made. We've said in our briefs that we think it's true that the issues of equitable estoppel are not before this court. There's two questions that you were asked to respond to.
So you're saying he, for his own reasons, took the risk of settling it to limit his exposure and is now looking around for a goodie bag.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's true. And in terms of lawyers' responsibilities, I don't know, but the personal injury lawyers and the corporate lawyers that I know, today one of the first things they do is they say, is there insurance for this? they're in a litigation, if they're concerned there's insurance, you know, or wondering if there's insurance on the other side, you serve a discovery request. You serve a request for production of documents.
You're going to have to be finished in 3 seconds.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate this court's attention, and
thank you.
Yep.
We look forward to your decision.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Ms. Hanlon.
Thank you. Quickly, the argument that there aren't any gaps here, gaps can happen here. You have to go and look to the notice provision in the policy. The notice provision says you have to give notice when you become aware of the claim, but not later than 60 days after the expiration date of the policy. So a gap can happen. That's on page 73 of the appendix. Number two, the affordability issue. I mean, we are talking in the ether here about this issue. Justice Boatwright, you talked about this. I mean, is there evidence in the record? It's all basically speculation. And if you look at the amicus briefs in support of Philadelphia's position, the Copic brief, it says, well, it may warrant a premium increase. The American Insurance Association brief says, well, it will likely be passed on to the insured. It could force insurers to charge higher premiums. This is all speculation. And the sky is falling argument that they're making, that prices are going to skyrocket. Show us the data. What happened in Wisconsin? Since 1999, when the Seventh Circuit said the notice prejudice rule under the statute applies both to claims-made policies and occurrence-based policies. Is claims-made insurance unaffordable in Wisconsin? You've seen nothing along those lines. The reasonable expectations argument that Mr. Kraft didn't reasonably expect anything.
You're very close to being finished.
That standard is an objective standard.
Thank
it's
you.
The standard.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Culp. The court will be in recess.